Mr. Evans, yes. I had forgot that.
Uh-huh. Danny Evans with the Department of Justice representing respondent Janet Napolitano, Secretary of Homeland Security. In 2002, Mr. Bayo applied for admission to this country. He showed an immigration inspector a Belgian passport that lacked a visa, and he signed the waiver at issue in this case.
So, Mr. Evans, I want to start right there, because the more I've looked at this case, the less I have been convinced that it really has anything to do with the visa waiver program, because Mr. Bayo presented a fraudulent passport. And had the government found him 10 days after he'd entered the country, he would have been subject, as I understand it, to immediate removal. So I don't see how he was here for a minute legally, much less the 90 days that the visa waiver program gives.
It's certainly one problem in this case, Your Honor.
It's a big problem because we don't sit to write advisory opinions, and if he was removable ab initio for use of a fraudulent document, as you well know, a whole different set of procedures govern him. He, at that point, would look just like somebody who walked across the border at Nuevo Laredo or in some other way. I mean, people enter the country illegally, unfortunately, all the time, and the government has well-established procedures for dealing with them.
Yes, Your Honor. There are two points I'd like to make in response. The first is that he was admitted, so clearly he would be charged under 237 in ordinary immigration court proceedings. And when I say 237, I'm referring to 8 U.S.C. 1227, yes.
Okay.
And so he'd be in immigration court.
But the thing is, he was admitted in error, just like anyone else who presents fraudulent documents. So I don't see how further signatures one way or the other on the visa waiver have much to do with his status.
Yes, sir. Well, what really matters in this case is the charge of removability, because it's not just that he came in under the visa waiver program, it's that he overstayed the terms.
Well,
of
but
the
he didn't really, I guess I'm thinking he didn't really come in under the visa, he purported to come in under the visa waiver program, but I don't see how he was entitled to acquire any rights one way or the other, whether for the 90 days to begin with, or I mean, it just seems to me like the whole visa waiver program falls out.
Well, it really is the central issue in the case, Your Honor, and I would say this because...
What's the it that you're talking about? I hate to ask a question like that.
And the waiver that you signed.
I know, and that's what everybody's briefed, but I'm worried about whether that's really at issue for the case of somebody who filed a fraudulent document. This is not like somebody from the United Kingdom who came in, overstayed the 90 days, wants to adjust status, et cetera, and now is subject to removal. That would be a case that pertains to most of the briefing here.
Your Honor, I'm sure that the Court has seen in many cases where aliens are removable under various provisions, several provisions. Sometimes a crime of moral turpitude is also an aggravated felony.
But the procedures usually don't vary. And in this case, these expedited procedures apply only to somebody who is eligible. And as I see it, it's a trade-off, as the government's pointed out. 16 million-some people come in. It's wonderful them. You know, your friend can come from England and visit without the paperwork hassle, so there's a great benefit to all. But the totally illegal alien who slips in from Nuevo Laredo gets a different set of procedures.
Well, it's true, but that's the person who came across the border without inspection is someone who never submitted themselves to the visa procedures at all, and I think that's a legitimate distinction.
Well, how about the person who comes in on a false passport? You know, we see lots of people from various countries, and actually comes up sometimes even in asylum cases. They come in with a phony document.
Yes, Your Honor, and if he had been caught at the border, he would have been turned around and removed promptly.
Right, so he didn't have the benefit of the 90 days, so I don't know why he should have the detriment of the visa waiver program.
Well, he really did have the benefit of
the 90 days. No, he didn't. He just wasn't caught.
It's true, but, and frankly, he could have been charged with being inadmissible at the time of admission.
Right.
The fact that he is inadmissible on multiple grounds, including overstaying the term of admission, is separate from the procedure under which he would be removed. Frankly, he could have been charged with removability for having a false document. It's just that he wasn't. But whatever the charge of removability, he came in under the visa waiver program, so clearly he's subject to the visa waiver procedure.
Well, I'm not sure I follow that, though. He fraudulently signed documents in conjunction with the visa waiver program. I'll go that far. And it wasn't caught at the border, and so nobody bothered him for the first, actually much longer than the first 90 days. But I don't see how the government can treat him as somebody. It's like a contract that's void ab initio. He signs this thing, but it's meaningless because he had no right to do it.
Well, I'm hesitant to agree with the court in describing it as a contract, and this is a situation where the government is administering a statute. So we don't have a contract. But if I point to the administrative record and the order of removal, the order of removal cites Section 237. That's 8 U.S.C. 1227. That is the ground of removability. The ground in this case was he overstayed the term of admission. They also could have charged him with inadmissible at the time that he was admitted. That's 1227A1A. They could have charged him as not having a proper document, which is separate from committing fraud. They could have charged him with committing fraud as well. Those are all grounds of removability that they could have charged him with. But what matters in this case is that clearly he came in under the visa waiver program.
You said that before.
Clearly.
And that dictates the procedure under which his removability is determined. And that's different from the ground of removability. So I think that the fact that he had a fraudulent passport.
I take it the question that Judge Wood is getting at is whether Section 217, 8 U.S.C. 1187, applies to people who attempt to enter under the program, which Bio did, or only to people who are eligible to enter under the program, which Bio wasn't. Is there any language in the statute that distinguishes between these two possibilities?
The inspectors are always asking.
I'm not asking about what the inspectors are asking. I'm asking about the language of the statute. Is there anything in the language of the statute that chooses between those two possibilities?
No specific language comes to mind. But
all right. Well, we'll want to hear from your adversary on this, and perhaps we will need supplemental briefs because we're not anxious to issue any advisory opinion.
No, of course not, Your Honor. But I assure the court that the question of the validity of the waiver is properly presented in this case.
You indicated there were he could have been charged under three different.
Those are the charges that come to mind.
Why this one?
Why this one? Because I think that the immigration officer is used to charging this because frequently you have an overstay. I mean,
that's not the best answer I've ever heard.
It's not, but if you think about who usually comes in under this program, it's people from Western Europe and.
But the best one is a fraudulent document.
Well, the immigration officer is thinking, here's someone who's been here for 4 years. That's far longer than the 90 days under which they were admitted, and nobody's going to argue about this. If you charge fraud, you have to prove fraud, potentially, and that could be a more complicated procedure than proving the overstay, which is clear on its face.
Didn't he concede that it was a phony Belgian passport?
I believe that he did.
Yeah, so. Yes.
So perhaps it would not have been too
not too tough if he's conceded.
But again, I do think that it's fairly common in these cases to charge the overstay. And really, that's a question of prosecutorial discretion. The fact that the government chooses one charge over another is something that happens all the time.
But if it doesn't fit the facts, you know.
Well, there are certainly other charges that would also fit the facts. But there's no question that the overstay charge does fit the facts. This is someone who stayed long after 90 days.
But I think he overstayed as long as he was here a day, actually, since he wasn't entitled to come in.
Well, on its face, he was admitted for 90 days. I understand the court's point, but he was admitted, and so he's treated as someone admitted as opposed to someone who's remaining at the border.
But I don't think the government would have treated him that way if, in my hypothetical, it had found him after day 10. Suppose he gets a speeding ticket, you know, and they run the check and they find out all the things they find in this case. I don't think the government would have said, oh, you know, we let him in under the visa waiver program so he can still stay here for another 80 days.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that it's possible that they would because
think so?
If they treat him under the visa waiver program, they can remove him promptly instead of putting him in immigration court.
But what I'm – so you think if they had caught him at day 10 because he was speeding or some – people were often picked up on traffic violations, you think the government would have considered itself estopped to remove him because he was admitted under the visa waiver program with a fraudulent passport?
No, I don't believe the government would be
stunned if that's the government's position.
If I can clarify with the court, once an alien is admitted, there is no procedure for expedited removal. The alien will be put in immigration court proceedings unless, for example, they're a non-lawful permanent resident aggravated felon.
Is that true even if he got the waiver fraudulently? Can't be expedited for removal?
Well, I think that the immigration inspectors are going to look at the waiver on its face. He signed it. He represented that he was a visa waiver.
But you're not answering the question, which is suppose, just for the sake of argument. I know they didn't find out till later here. They did find out that it was fraudulent at some point within that 90-day window. And the question is, you don't think he could be put in immigration detention? I mean, there are facilities for that. You don't think the government just would have said, well, have a nice life while we process your paperwork?
No, I'm sure that they would have aggressively attempted to remove him, and I believe that they would have done it under the visa waiver program.
But he's still okay under the visa waiver program at day 10.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you think they just would have given him the other 80 days because he fraudulently got himself entitled to them?
Well, no. I mean, they certainly would have found if he becomes removable the minute after he's admitted, the fact that he was admitted for 90 days doesn't change the fact that
that's what I'm trying to get at. Yeah. So
clearly the government could go after him the minute after admission if they found that the passport
they happened to find out. Yeah.
But they didn't. And I think that they followed their usual procedure in this case, and they made a choice of prosecutorial discretion under which charge that they would allege against him. And I think that the court has to take this case as it finds it, that he's charged as an overstay. To point out perhaps a variation on this issue, there's a footnote in the panel opinion talking about how the visa waiver program even treats aliens who are not from visa waiver countries as visa waiver applicants and admittees, and the board has issued a decision saying the same thing. And that's proper. That's correct. It's consistent with, actually, the presumption that the aliens know the law that governs their admission. And when an alien comes up and represents to an immigration inspector that they're from a visa waiver country, the immigration inspector is entitled to take them at face value. And the alien bears the consequences of that representation when 90 days later or the moment after they're admitted, they're found to be removable. That's when they're put in visa waiver removal proceedings.
Mr. Evans, I have a very simple question for you. It seems that the ESTA system will eliminate most of the concerns that have been raised in this case. Is that accurate?
We don't believe so, Your Honor. There are still substantial differences between ESTA and visa application. A visa applicant must go to the consulate or the embassy and make a personal appearance. They have to submit their fingerprints before they ever leave their country.
But is there a visa waiver program like the old one? I thought ESTA replaced the old visa waiver process.
No, Your Honor. ESTA is simply travel authorization. The alien still comes into the United States under the visa waiver program. It's exactly the same statute. Nothing changes. The only question is, how does the alien submit their waiver?
But the procedures have changed, and I think that's what Judge Rovner
exactly.
was
that would have
driving
been
at.
Yes, and the procedures are now that the alien from overseas goes on the Internet and fills out a form online or has their travel agent do it or someone do that. And that gives the Department of Homeland Security an opportunity to run some checks on the alien before they come to the United States. And their arrival could be prevented if some problem is found.
Well, what response do you have to this question as to whether his removal order was issued by an authorized official?
Your Honor, having looked at the regulations, it's clear that the authority of the district director can be delegated. And I think that answers the question. But I've looked at the specific officials who signed the orders in this case, and it does appear that an acting resident agent in charge is authorized to sign a visa waiver removal order. There's nothing in the record that establishes that, but I can provide that to the court if it's necessary. The resident agent in charge, if I can point out, signed the notice of intent and not the actual removal order. The actual removal order was signed by a deportation officer. I don't believe the deportation officer has the authority to do that. I believe that's harmless error. There was no response to the notice of intent to remove, and as I said, it's harmless error in this case.
Going back to that electronic system again,
yes,
if a French-speaking person completed the registration online but then later said he didn't understand what he was agreeing to, should that person receive a hearing on whether his waiver was a knowing one?
Well, that certainly is a problem that could arise with ESTA because travel agents can fill out the online form. But the answer, Your Honor, is no. The alien is still held to a presumption of the knowledge of the law, and we believe that that presumption is sufficient to establish the validity of the waiver that they execute.
But that, I think Judge Williams' question is a little bit different. Because as I understand your argument, there really is no knowledge requirement at all. And so the government could present the visa waiver paperwork written in Attic Greek, and it would be fine, because as long as the person signed on the dotted line, since their knowledge isn't important, and you could go back and look at the U.S. Code and find the various statutes and regulations, it's your position that the Attic Greek form is a perfectly good one to give to somebody who's executing the waiver.
Well, Your Honor, not the facts in this case.
I know it isn't, but I'm asking, I'm trying to find out how far you're willing to push your position that actual knowledge is irrelevant.
Well, the position is that...
And in my example, I assume most of us in the courtroom don't actually read Attic Greek. I don't think that's too much of a stretch. So... If that's what the form said, despite the fact that, of course, somebody who had a quick laptop and could get into Westlaw might be able to see that the statute said something else, I think the logic of your position is that that's fine.
I don't think you have to embrace that logic. We talk about English. No. People come to the United States, the language is English. Kind of odd for them to be signing a form in a language they don't understand. If someone is given this form and says, you know, I don't understand, I can't read English, is there someone they can ask? Can you ask someone at the port of entry or can you say I have to consult a lawyer or something?
Well, I'm sure the circumstances vary, but having listened to the original argument in this case, I believe that my opposing counsel agreed that the waiver forms are available in many languages. So there's at least that amelioration.
In French? Is he a French speaker, this person?
He claims to be a French speaker, yes, my understanding.
So French would be one of the languages,
presumably. I don't know for sure, but I can't imagine.
Well, sure.
Not. Your Honor, As Judge Posner points out, the statutes here in the United States are written in English.
I'm well aware that English is the predominant language in the United States.
But you have argued, though,
in your brief that actual knowledge, that you can waive a right without actually knowing about it. And I find that a broad and troublesome proposition. As I say, I'm not really sure whether any of this pertains to Mr. Bio, but assuming for the moment it does, that seems to be an extreme position. And I'm not aware of anywhere else in the law where you can actually waive something of which you are completely ignorant.
Well, Your Honor, we would point to the Schneckloth case.
I don't think Schneckloth holds that at all.
Well, I think that Schneckloth says that
there's no need for warnings.
And there is no need for
Has anybody discussed the bearing of the Amataya case, Japanese immigration case? Because as I read that case, the Supreme Court held that an alien who was asked to sign a document in English and later says he didn't understand it loses. Yamataya seems to say that if you're asked to sign an immigration document in a language you don't understand, you have to ask for it to be translated. You can't sign it first and litigate later about your understanding.
That is what that 1896 case said.
It's 1903, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But I'm puzzled by the fact that there hasn't been much focus on that case here.
Well, we do cite
and it does seem highly pertinent.
It's cited in the footnote in the government's supplemental brief. And it does say that the aliens are essentially held to be accountable for knowing the English language. It's a rather broad proposition.
Well, I think what it says is that if you sign a document, you're bound by its contents. You have to say before you sign, I don't understand, please translate. But that, I think, is what it held.
If that is what it, I don't recall offhand what document was signed by the alien in that case. But if the court said that, then it is supportive of our position. There are several other cases that say that.
Supportive is not the word I'd use. Dispositive is the word I would use.
You don't
it
need
is a decision of the Supreme Court, after all.
You don't need the fiction of people knowing the law, which is ridiculous. It's simply that if you sign a contract, you're bound. You don't know what you may not know what's in the contract. May not understand it at all.
So he doesn't think it's a contract.
Exactly. Pardon?
I said, unfortunately, he doesn't think it's a contract. So
well,
I don't know what that does.
Call it a contract because it's a matter of the government administering its statutes. But given the
but
presumption
due process
of the law,
normally suggests, putting the Yamataya case to one side, that you know what you are doing. And you have argued, not on the basis of some general, you come to the United States at your peril if you don't alert people to the fact that you don't speak English. You're trying to say, in a much broader sense, that a waiver happens even if you don't know what you're doing. And that's a troublesome proposition, as the amici have pointed out, in the context of trafficking, in the context of all these sorts of abusive procedures that take place, where people are perhaps signing things that they never even saw. And I guess the analogy that I've seen to your position, we have another area in immigration where expedited procedures are used, and that's where an aggravated felony has been committed. And for the most part, there's no judicial review of that, except we do review to make sure that the thing that the person did really is an aggravated felony, and we do review to make sure that this was the person. You know, you are the Mr. X who did this thing. And similarly, in this instance, I can certainly see limitations on judicial review, but I don't see why there shouldn't, when the question comes up, be some assurance that somebody wasn't, you know, bound and blindfolded and signing something that they had no ability to learn about.
Well,
or
Your Honor, that certainly raises a concern. And if somebody claimed that they had involuntarily signed the waiver, that it was done against their will, that they were involuntarily intoxicated, that they were incompetent to sign it. Those are all legitimate claims.
And I want to know where you insert that in the law, because you say that in your brief, and yet it sounds very ad hoc. And where's the legal flexibility for that, and how do you put that on one side of a line and Mr. Bai? Maybe you can do it. I don't know, but I don't see where that distinction comes in.
Well, the question is the statute, that's 1187B2, uses the word waiver. What does that mean? And the word needs to be interpreted in the context in which it's placed. Yes, generally speaking, the relinquishment or the voluntary relinquishment of a knowing right. We believe that the presumption of knowledge covers the knowledge part, and that voluntariness is the other component. If an alien claimed that they were involuntarily signed the waiver, that's another case. It's a stronger case than this one, and possibly if they were able to show that they had been smuggled in or were otherwise the victim of trafficking, that's a legitimate claim. And I believe that that's actually consistent with, for example, Schneckloth's view of waivers.
Bio concedes he signed this document and concedes.
It's not an issue here at all, and that's on the page 7 of his original opening brief. He admits that he voluntarily signed this waiver. So the only question here is whether or not he can also raise a separate issue regarding whether he knew what he was signing. And allowing him to do that 4 years, at this point it's almost 7 years, after he was admitted is just completely inconsistent with the idea that aliens should, to some extent, be held to know the law and the terms of their admission.
Well, no, not held to know the law. They don't know the law. But can the visa waiver program actually survive if this fellow has a right to challenge? I mean, what kind of adjustments would have to be made if any applicant can say, oh, years later, I didn't know what I was signing. I don't know the language well enough.
As the court mentioned earlier, 16 million people, I believe now 17 million people are coming in a year on the visa waiver program. If the government is put in a position of having to build a record at the time of admission so that it can prove 7 years later that somebody voluntarily and knowingly, if that's the standard, signed the waiver, it presents a tremendous obstacle for continuing the program.
Mr. Evans, how has the department been handling the situation in the Fifth Circuit since Noize?
Well, it's true that not many cases have come up after the Noize case came out. That was 1993.
Isn't that just about the most important response to everything that's going on here, that you have for all these years had Noize? And boy, it's working.
Well, Your Honor,
and the Fifth Circuit is a border circuit.
But the countries that border the Fifth Circuit are not members of the VWP, or not
That's
of the
true.
35 countries. In fact, none of the South American countries are they?
But Houston's the 10th biggest port of entry, if I recall, in the United States. New Orleans is a tremendously important port.
It's true. And so there will
well.
Be likely some VWP applicants there. But
significant numbers, I think.
And I want to get back to this whole coercion issue, because you agree, I take it, that there are some circumstances where a hearing would be required. Because I don't know if you've answered
exactly.
that question
exactly.
directly.
It's not this case, especially where we have a concession that this was voluntary.
And I understand that's your position, but I want to see, are you agreeing that there are circumstances, whether it's coercive or someone was forced, whatever the situation, where a hearing might be required?
Yes, Your
Honor. And so what if the form is filled out with the name and address in the wrong place, and the country and the address are in a language that's different from the one printed on the form? If that person says that his waiver was not knowing, would that be a good argument? Should that person get a hearing? I'm trying to get to the, how we draw the line on where a hearing is required.
Yes, Your Honor. The government has conceded in briefs in this case that there are issues an alien could raise, including whether or not the person identified by the immigration officers as being the alien who was admitted under the visa waiver program. They could dispute whether or not they were actually admitted under that program. Sometimes aliens leave the United States and then come back, and the immigration authorities may not be aware of that. So there are certainly issues that an alien could raise before an immigration officer who's trying to remove that person. And those are legitimate issues, and they could be considered.
And where does the statute, consistent with the visa waiver program, give them a right to a hearing on those points?
The statute does not mention a
it
hearing.
It doesn't. And
the
so that's the problem.
The mentions a determination by the district director, and we are conceding that those issues could be raised before here.
So, are you now saying
that there can be a right to review of whether a waiver was knowing and voluntary, because that is a 360-degree turn here?
Yeah, Your Honor, we do not agree that knowingness is an issue. That the knowledge part as a separate issue, it cannot be part of what makes a waiver valid. Otherwise, the program does fall apart.
So there can never be a right to review of whether a waiver was knowing and voluntary. Even
whether
if someone signed the waiver because of coercion, trickery, all of the terrible things.
The government is trying to separate the idea of a knowing waiver as opposed to a voluntary waiver.
That all goes to the question of the legal standard that governs the validity
does.
Of the waiver. You
what
have to address
the
threshold question.
What is the waiver
question?
That's required? And the government's point here is that a voluntary waiver is necessary, but a knowing waiver where the alien can allege they didn't know and make that claim many years after their admission simply can't be the standard. It's
And how is it that you're separating voluntary from knowing?
Because the question of what is necessary for the waiver depends on the context, and the Supreme Court, for example, in Schneckloth, recognized that a separate knowing component is not always necessary to have a valid waiver, in that case, a consent to a search.
Well, that was a different way. I mean, as Chief Judge Easterbrook said, that was about warnings in advance as opposed to, and in the whole context of criminal procedure, where sometimes, you know, there's Miranda out there for some kinds of things, there are other standards elsewhere. I'm not sure that Schneckloth stands for this very broad proposition.
Oh,
I mean, you've got so many other cases, starting with Johnson against Zerbst and going forward, where a waiver is a knowing relinquishment of a known right. The Supreme Court's line of cases, United States against Olano, where waiver is affirmatively giving up something, whereas forfeiture is just forgetting to say something about it. I mean, you're swimming upstream, I think,
Your Honor,
on this part.
Schneckloth shows that the nature of the waiver can vary depending on the context. And,
okay.
And Schneckloth said you don't need a knowing waiver when a citizen is consenting to search and thereby giving up their Fourth Amendment rights.
Your time is up, so I'm not going to.
It certainly is a different context. Just one last point, and that is that the government would refer regarding the Matthews against Eldridge balancing test to a decision by this court. It's mentioned in the amicus brief at page 6, Gomez-Chavez against Perryman, and that's at 308 Fed 3rd, 786.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, Ms. Anderson.
Lorraine Anderson for the petitioner, Mohammed Bayo. We were here approximately a year ago on this exact same thing, and at that time I explained that Mr. Bayo, a citizen of Guinea, a French-speaking country, entered the United States in 2002 under the visa waiver program using a fraudulent passport.
So, Ms. Anderson, I have two questions for you. One of them is the same question I was trying to explore with Mr. Evans, which is how this case can have anything to do with the visa waiver program, since he was certainly not entitled to enter the United States through the fraudulent use of anybody's passport. But my second question is, even if we build the visa waiver program back into it, it's very difficult for me to see at the end of the day how Mr. Bayo has been prejudiced by any of the things that have happened, since if you reset the clock, he'd be ineligible. He's not in this country legitimately, and you seem to think he's suddenly eligible to adjust his status based on his marriage, and I just don't see where the final prejudice to him lies.
Well, to answer the first part of your question, in Zine versus Mukasey, it was found that an entrant under the visa waiver program, whether or not they actually were from a BWP country, was bound by the terms of the visa waiver program. So therefore, we proceeded under
that. Well, that's a little different than a stolen document.
I understand that, Your Honor. There is the issue of the fraud. And the second
part, which is kind of the giant elephant in the room issue, isn't it? Oh, well, there's the issue of the fraud.
Well, if he wasn't subject to the visa waiver program procedures, he would be subject to the normal procedures of removal under the INA. And at that point, he would have to defend the use of the fraudulent passport, and he would have other remedies available to him, and he would present those within the normal framework. In this situation,
wouldn't it have been in his interest for you to argue for that outcome? It looks like a somewhat better set of procedures for him.
We initially did raise those issues, and at the time of the supplemental briefing in the first instance in this case, the court became specifically interested in the issue of the waiver, and we moved forward based upon that issue, and we presented the argument in that instance. Additionally, I do apologize, I forget some of what your second question was.
Prejudice. I mean, why is he prejudiced in the final analysis?
In terms of the prejudice in this situation, Mr. Bayo, had he been sent away in the first instance, he would not have entered the United States, he would not have married, he would have not have had a family here in the United States, and he would have been, in order to enter the United States, forced to obtain a B visa. Had he entered with a B visa at that time?
But I think you're saying that the only benefit he would derive from winning this case would be a delay because of the procedures required for removal. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not certain I'm following your question in that if...
Would he have a defense to a charge of fraudulent entry?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
What would his defense
there
be?
There is a waiver for fraud in the use of a fraudulent visa. There are individuals that enter under the B visa program that utilize a fraudulent passport do have the opportunity to waive that fraud if they're an immediate relative to a U.S. citizen. So
let me ask you a slightly different question. What procedures would you suggest that the government institute in order to make sure that these waivers are are knowing?
Well, Your Honor, we would suggest that the government has an opportunity similar to that of expedited removal, where you could do a very short, very precise questioning of the individual.
Well, is this like a plea? This would be like a plea colloquy?
Is this at the front end or the back end?
If you would, you walk the person through the rights he's giving up and ask him what he understands those to mean?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The fact is the government did require a waiver in these situations, and they have established, as was previously mentioned, a new program in order to give individuals an opportunity on the front end to know what exactly
Well, I don't understand. I don't understand what you're saying. You have a person coming, obviously, from a foreign country, assuming it's not an English-speaking country. What procedure at entry should the government use to make sure the person knows that he's waiving certain rights?
If we were to do it in, if the government were to see fit that that was the best way to proceed, they could do it initially at the entrance with the immigration officer.
What I'm asking you concretely, what do they do? Is this like a criminal rule 12 plea colloquy?
I would suggest that they would need to do it at that time before the person would perfect the entry. Therefore, there would
be
no
question. 17 million plea colloquies. That sounds like a lot.
Well, I think that the vast majority of people that have received the waiver have received it in their language. The waiver is available in all of the major languages under which the visa waiver program pertains.
Would it be, in your mind, much different than coming through customs, for instance?
It's very similar to coming through customs, and it could be made very similar to coming through customs in that as long as the individual has a understanding of what the document entails.
Yes, I know. The question is, how do you elicit whether he has that understanding? Now, wasn't there a French form he could have asked for?
He could have asked for a French form if he was aware that the French
okay,
form
Okay, so how does this colloquy proceed? Do you have to ask him? Do you have to ask him whether he can read the form, whether he reads it in English? Is that what you do?
It certainly seems a place to start, assuming that we would do
it. Well, if you give him the French form, do you have to explain it to him, or?
I don't think it's necessary. The government isn't in a position to provide.
Is that all that's involved, that instead of his having to ask for the form in French, the government has to offer him, has to say to him, if your English is bad, what's the language you read best in, and we'll give you a form in that language? Is that what you want?
I do think that would definitely be a place to start. And
okay, that's a place to start. Now, where do you finish? Do you finish there? Okay, you're a French speaker. Here's your French form. Read it. Sign it if you want.
Thanks, Billy.
Leave me alone. Or does he have to explain what's in the form?
I don't think it's necessary, again, to reiterate, the government isn't in a position.
Answer my question. Is it enough just to give the person a French form, or is there some further explanation that the government
there
has to undertake?
There shouldn't be any further explanation.
So
necessary.
You just give the form.
As long as the
and that's
form,
the end of it.
As long as the form is clear and understandable.
Well, wait a second. Clear. Is the English form clear for English speakers?
For English speakers, it's not necessarily what I would constitute as completely clear. Because
is it constitutional? Is it constitutional?
It is a difficult form to understand, but I do think it could pass.
If it's translated accurately into French, all you have to do is give this fellow the French form. Is that it? That's the end.
Appears to generally be working. Obviously, there's only been.
Is that, in your view, constitutionally adequate?
It should be constitutionally adequate.
Without any changes in the language, because you're talking. Part of your answer is it's not clear enough. There needs to be more basic language. Is that what you're trying to say?
I would say that it should offer a clear language, because one of the parts of the waiver actually states in it that you have no rights to rebut, you know, removal, except for in terms unless you're an immediate relative.
Well, it says 201B, as a matter of fact, what it says.
Yeah, it doesn't break it down.
Well, and in that of itself would be questionable.
But why is that questionable? I mean, I'm surprised that you are falling into the trap of putting all of this at the front end, namely at the time somebody executes the visa waiver, because there are 17 million of these things. The overwhelming majority, at least the Fifth Circuit's experience seems to indicate, are legitimately obtained, you know, by your college roommate who now lives in England and is coming to visit you for a few weeks and is very happy to go back to England afterwards, et cetera. Why aren't you just arguing for a back-end provision where for the trafficking victim, for the person who didn't understand, for the person who says it wasn't knowing, to have a Matthews against Eldridge balanced, you know, small amount of an opportunity to make this point? I can't conceive of a front-end remedy that would make anything but insanely burdensome procedures for the government based on the number of abuses there seem to be.
I'm not suggesting that it necessarily has to be a front-end procedure. What I'm suggesting on the front end is that at the very minimum, it should be made available.
No, you said it was constitutionally adequate.
You said it was constitutionally adequate, but I'm even saying in his case, they give him this form in English, he signs it, now he's at the back end, and he wants to say his signature. So he is, instead of an N of 17 million, he's an N of a much smaller number, you know, of the abusers. And so I don't understand why you're not saying at that point, when the question of knowingness and voluntariness has now suddenly become relevant, what's the burden for the government there? How many, what do your statistics show about how many cases turn out to be a problem?
Let me go back to address what I was saying before. In that, the waiver must be clear and precise in a language that a person understands in order for it to pass constitutional muster. At this time, the actual waiver itself hasn't been prepared in such a way that it is perfectly clear and has been available at appropriate times in the language.
But if it were clear, what room would there be for any subsequent proceedings?
I'm sorry?
If the form were clear in the person's language, what occasion would there be for any subsequent proceedings?
For instance, in the present case where it wasn't made available in the appropriate language.
Of course. I mean, look, what I'm saying is, if you listen to me, if it's a clear document in the language of the person who's applying, what room is there for some later proceeding to determine whether the waiver was knowing?
I'm not certain I understand your question, sir, and I would like to answer it, sir.
You said, suppose the form is clear. Suppose he's given a French form. He speaks French, and it's perfectly clear. You've rewritten it, so that it's perfectly clear, and DHS has adopted it. Now, after he's signed it, what room is there for some subsequent proceeding in which he would say, no, it wasn't a knowing waiver?
Well, there would be the situation in terms of the voluntary
issue. I'm talking about knowing waiver.
If you don't understand the language of the form, sir.
But I just told you they've given him the form in his language. He says, I read French. Give me the French form. He gives them a French form. It's clear. Now, how could you ever have a later proceeding to determine whether it was a knowing waiver?
Well, statutory construction supports that a waiver must be both knowing and voluntary, and that is
You sure aren't following what I'm saying.
I'm sorry.
We're focusing on knowing, not coercion or anything like that. We've given him the form that you agree, because we're letting you rewrite it. He's giving him the form in his language. It's perfectly clear. Okay? And he signs it. So how could he argue later that it wasn't a knowing waiver?
Not understanding the language of the form, and I understand what you're saying, that it's very clear, but those are the situations that
he asked for the French form. He's given the French form. It's a It's an accurate and idiomatic translation of the of an English form, which you agree is clear. And he signs it. So how could it not be a knowing waiver?
I'm uncertain, Your Honor. I would suggest that if an individual states at the time that they would be subject to some type of removal, that they did not understand the waiver, that they would have some type of opportunity to address that in at least a very minimum situation in order for an immigration officer to deduce whether or not the individual understood. In the NOS court, they determined that the issue of knowing waiver, had the test applied? Did the person have the necessary understanding in terms of language, education? Had they discussed the waiver itself with another individual, such as an immigration specialist or an attorney? And that in and of itself made the court determine that it couldn't be a knowing waiver. There are other instances where simply by the language itself and thinking that you understand and thinking that you know what the waiver is saying doesn't necessarily constitute knowing. It could, you know, it could have certain
language. So you really are pushing for a plea colloquy.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You're pushing for a plea colloquy at the day, at the time of entry.
Not necessarily. What we would suggest is that at the time that they would be made available, in addition to making certain that the waiver itself is clear and understandable and available in the individual's language, that at the time, if they were subject to some type of proceedings, as they, as Mr. Bile has been here, where he was issued with the notice of intent and then issued with the notice of removal without any type of procedural aspects in between for him to address this matter, that he should have been given some type of instance where he could have indicated that he didn't understand, didn't know, or wasn't aware of the document that he was signing. There was no procedure made available to him in order to make those types of arguments or to bring that type of
issue. Ms. Anderson, but I think Judge Posner is trying to establish, if we can get there, and I'm not sure you want to go there, is there some initial inquiry that would satisfy the approach that you think is necessary to make comfortable the applicant? Or do we always have to have at the back end some review to see whether or not educational levels were high enough and the like?
We would suggest that we would, you know, the agency does have the authority to determine how that would go forward, but presently they have no process by which to make that type of determination.
That almost sounds too much, though. I mean, what they seem to be telling us is that they have a very ad hoc process. Some, you know, the human trafficking people get a process, but the Mr. Bios of the world don't.
Well, again, that's at the back end
in
terms of did they voluntarily waive the right. And the government has conceded that there is a voluntariness to the waiver. Well, the voluntariness would beg the question of the knowledge. If there's a voluntariness, well, do you have to know what you're voluntarily doing?
Your client does not present a case of involuntariness, does he?
No, he does not present the case
of involuntariness. Concedes that he signed that document and was not forced to.
He did sign the document.
And was not forced to.
What do you think of the new electronic? Do you think that meets constitutional muster? Should there be more in that?
Well, the new process, I think, could possibly address some of the issues that the government has in terms of the possibility of fraud or other elements that, you know, that they want to prevent individuals from entering. But there are still issues where the government is, in fact, allowing other individuals to file this on your behalf. You may never see this document. You may never know of its existence. If this is, in fact, a waiver, and the term waiver constitutes the need to give up and knowingly and voluntarily to give up a right, it does beg the question, how can you do that if you don't even see the form itself?
Can I take you back to a statement you made earlier that with regard to the fraudulent entry, that there, if he then subsequently marries an American citizen, that's going to be, can be virtually eliminated and he could
That the fraud itself can be waived under the INA, and they can adjust status in the United States if you are an immediate relative, in other words, married to a U.S. citizen.
So you steal a document, come in, and then the federal government can say, no problem.
The government has statutorily made those individuals eligible for adjustment of status.
It's wholly discretionary, right?
It is.
So they may decide that
not every individual will be granted the waiver. They will have the opportunity to present the waiver. So therefore, they would have the opportunity to present the information necessary for a deportation officer to give them the discretionary, you know, opportunity to adjust status here in the United States. Are there any other questions? Should I proceed? Okay. Basically, what we would argue here, or what we would suggest, is that the decision was correct initially in the panel, that there is a need for a knowing and voluntary waiver in this situation, just as was found in the NOS test, and just as this court found in Wigglesworth, that although the court in those instances chose not to, and because it wasn't a fact-finding mission at that time, and there's no record in this situation, did not grant the...
Does waiver have to mean the same thing in an immigration case as it does in a criminal case?
In terms of a waiver of a constitutional right, I'm unsure of that, to tell you the truth, because criminal law has a long history of the word and the use of the waiver. In this instance, we don't have many... times in the INA where the use of the term waiver actually exists. So
actually, in 1187B, which refers to the alien's waiver, it refers in the very same sentence to the waiver of the visa. Whatever the waiver of the visa is, it's not a surrender of a constitutional right. That's not subject to the standards of Johnson against Zerbst. Why would the same word in a single sentence have two such different meanings?
Well, I think because the waiver in terms of the ability to seek proceedings is what distinguishes those two items. Not everyone has the right to a visa. People are denied the right to a visa every day. So waiving the need for a visa...
I don't understand that. The thing being that when the government is waiving the visa requirement, it doesn't have anything to do with whether the alien's rights. The government is waiving a procedural hurdle.
Right.
That's the basis of my question. Right. Getting rid of a procedural hurdle is the sense of waiver in that sentence, and then it's used again to refer to the alien signing something. My question is just a matter of interpretation. Why would the same word in the space of less than a sentence, in the single clause of a sentence, have two such disparate meanings?
Well, I don't think in terms of what the government said, that could be replaced, that term waiver. The government...
It could be, but it isn't, right? It's there. It's in the statute.
And I would suggest that because of the type of the fact that they even have this document, and they have the document that requires the alien to sign it, agreeing to certain things...
No, you're not addressing my question. Let me just move on to a different question. What is your response to Yamataya, to the bearing of Yamataya on this case?
The case that you referred to earlier in terms of an individual...
Yamataya against Fisher, the Japanese immigration case from 1903.
Right. As far as I'm aware, that didn't actually require a waiver, and that the language...
The reason I'm asking is because the Supreme Court says if the government asks an immigrant or a would-be immigrant to sign a document, hands it over in English, and the person doesn't read English, he can't say later on, I didn't read English. It's his burden before signing it to say, give it to me in a language I understand, or translate it for me. Right? It seems to me, at least, to establish the principle that somebody who signs without asking for a translation can't later come back and say, yeah, but I don't read English. Now, is that a correct understanding of what Yamataya said, or is, you know, maybe I'm completely wrong in reading the case?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I'm not familiar enough with the facts to be able to specifically...
Okay.
Have you ever yourself signed an application or contract or anything like that in a foreign language that you didn't understand?
I did live in France for a while before learning the language of French, so it's possible that I would have had that opportunity. But I can't specifically.
But now, if you
that.
Had, if you not knowing French had signed a contract or an application, wouldn't you be a little sheepish about later saying, well, you shouldn't enforce this against me because I signed it, but I didn't have any idea what I was signing because I didn't know the language? It relates to this question whether a sensible regime would place some burden on the foreigner of saying, you know, I don't understand this, or do you have a French translation of this because I don't know what I'm giving up. Why not just make clear that you have to do that? It's minimum. Because if they won't give you any help, you know, well, maybe that's a different case. Maybe they have to help you.
But at the same time, in this instance, there was a French language document available. They were leaving from the country.
Yes, I know. But I'm asking, you come in, you can't read English, supposedly. Can't read English, and you're asked to sign something in English. Shouldn't you at least ask? Maybe you shouldn't be required to do any more, but shouldn't you at least ask, could you give me a French translation of this?
And there, of course, there should be room that every individual has to be responsible for themselves. To a
That's very minimum, but isn't it?
It is minimum. However, you have to actually even know that the document exists. You have to get
know that it exists? Wait.
In another language.
First, you have to ask, right? You ask, say, give me a copy in French.
Yeah.
And if the flight attendant or the person at the desk says, I don't have it in French, then you'd have a more interesting problem.
Or you say, j'ai besoin de la version française. I mean, you say something that communicates that you're not reading.
We don't know what occurred. There was no fact-finding here.
I assume Judge Wood's question was in Attic Greek, since I don't speak French. Bio wouldn't want to ask that question, though, because it would have called attention to his status, wouldn't it?
There is that possible issue, but again, going back to what I said, we don't know what actually occurred.
What do you mean we don't know what actually occurred? Was your client deprived of the opportunity to file an affidavit explaining what actually occurred? It's easy to file affidavits in litigation.
Absolutely, and he had, again, this occurred quite a while ago and from the time that he was picked up. And from his recollection, he signed the document because he was told to sign it.
Yeah, fine. But did he file an affidavit saying, for example, I asked for a copy in French and they told me, go fish?
He has not filed an affidavit in this matter.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. If he were allowed to contest his removal, would he raise any challenges to the removal other than he should receive the adjustment in status, which is, of course, discretionary?
There's also voluntary departure, which under normal circumstances he would be eligible for, which would allow him to seek immigration benefits in the future outside of the country. And under normal circumstances, had you entered the country unlawfully, had you overstayed a visa or any of those other types of entries that are not within the normal course, you would have that available to you.
And but that's a procedural benefit. It's not a substantive right.
That's correct. But it is one of the benefits if you were to get immigration removal proceedings or anything else, or even determine. Again, we have no scheme in place to determine in terms of the waiver and what kind of options might be available if the government were to adopt some type of scheme in terms of assessing the waiver. That might also be an option available to those individuals that did not understand the waiver and overstayed under the visa waiver program.
How did he obtain the Belgian passport?
He has indicated to me that it was provided to him by his cousin, and he was told that it would allow him to visit the United States.
A French-speaking Belgian, no doubt.
Pardon?
A French-speaking Belgian, no doubt.
Belgium. It is. He is from Guinea, and evidently there is some relationship between Belgium and numerous countries in Africa, and his cousin lived in Belgium, and he obtained the passport in that manner.
Don't we have the basic problem that whether he understood the waiver is a factual question, and no fact finder has yet answered this question.
Absolutely. There's no record here in terms, except for the documents that were provided to Mr. Bio. No record has been established regarding what happened at the time of entry, what happened at the time of being picked up as far as his application for adjustment. None of that is in the record, and there's been no questioning by the petitioner in terms of what has occurred. We know nothing, but the fact is there's no process. Going back to those individuals that might have come here under duress, there's been no process set in place for those individuals either, as Amici has pointed out. And so at a very minimum, some type of basic fact-finding could be set in place that would allow for some type of record to be established in order to determine the situation as in this case and in others. Well, I believe my time is short, so I would just go ahead and say once again that we have the panel decision, and we would suggest that the decision was correct, that there can be a system established, there can be a scheme established by the government in order to address this particular issue of did an individual properly and knowingly sign a waiver to the visa waiver program and give up the right for any type of procedure after the fact.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. I think we need to go back to where Judge Wood opened the oral argument. We have some antecedent questions here that we may need to consider in light of our obligation not to reach constitutional questions gratuitously. So I invite the parties to file post-argument briefs within 14 days, simultaneous briefs, addressing four questions. One is whether Section 1187 applies at all to an alien who is not from a country on one of the participating country lists. Whether the regulations expand the scope of the visa waiver program in any way beyond what 1187 itself does. Third, whether a person who enters with a fraudulent passport has an entitlement to have removal deferred while he applies for a waiver of some kind. And fourth, whether these questions have been waived or forfeited. All right? And we will look forward to receiving those supplemental briefs within 14 days. The case is taken under advisement. The court will now be in recess.